I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Thanks, Ken. I'm glad to be here.
You know, I'm probably like a number of our listeners who might be keen to get involved with commercial property, but not sure how or where to make a start. Maybe it's lack of equity, or perhaps it's just an initial hesitancy. A while back, you touched on the concept of property syndicates, but I don't think you really took it much further. Would that be one way smaller investors could more confidently step into the commercial property market?
Since the global financial crisis, there hasn't been a lot of activity with syndicates, either public or private. People, when they think of group investments, think mainly of property trusts, which are generally listed. But a syndicate allows a group of people, and the syndicate is generally defined as a joint purchase by a group of investors who come together to pool their funds to purchase and hold a property. So, in other words, you bring together with a private syndicate friends, family, or groups of like-minded investors who want to achieve a common investment goal. Now, there are thousands of syndicates around Australia. The public syndicates, however, have 200 or 300 investors involved, and generally, you don't have a lot of say in how they operate. It's really simply you signing across a check and then getting computerised bits of paper and updates along the way. You may get the opportunity to meet from time to time, but generally you don't have a lot of say in what goes on. And in most cases, the property has already been purchased, and so you're plugging into an existing property. And if it hasn't been purchased, it's held under option while the equity is put together. So what are some of the pitfalls of a public syndicate? Well, it involves preparing a product disclosure statement, which costs money, generally the best part of $200,000-$300,000. You've got rather hefty entrepreneurial fees for the people that put the project together. There's other establishment costs. Plus, there are some quite significant fees paid to accountants, solicitors, and financial planners to introduce their clients to help fill the syndicate equity requirements. So quite often, 15% of the money that you provide will be siphoned off to cover these sort of costs. So you can understand why some people get a bit concerned about that. And also, the entrepreneur putting a public syndicate together, which may be more than one person, generally will take a 3 or 4 month option over the property that they're wanting to secure. They identify it and they take an option over it. But when you stop to think about it, from a vendor's point of view, you can't negotiate a good price with that vendor because the vendor has to sit and wait for 3-4 months while the syndicate equity is accumulated by people that the entrepreneur doesn't yet know. So you've got to look at some of the concerns you might have. Generally, with a public syndicate, you're locked into that syndicate for a 10-year period, and you don't really have any pre-agreed way of getting your equity out. As I said, there are considerable upfront fees. You really don't have a say in the property. More often than not, the property is heavily geared, so the borrowing is significant. And in many situations, you're just one of a large number of investors, and so you don't really feel that you have much involvement or say in what goes on, and in fact you won't. So the obverse is a private syndicate where you have a much greater input, say, and involvement.
Now you've clarified the difference between public and private syndicates, could you perhaps explain what goes into making it a good private syndicate?
Well, my involvement goes back to the early 90s when I started helping some of my clients put these syndicates together. And I guess the question I asked was, why should you be required to pay all these upfront fees? And my underlying premise has always been that a syndicate ought not incur any more costs than if you as an individual were to buy the property yourself. And so if you look at the things like in comparing public to private syndicates, as I said, you've got 200 or 300 in a public syndicate. You have only a maximum of 20 in a private syndicate. And the reason for that is that anything over that, ASIC will require you to have a product disclosure statement. And as I said, that runs into the $200,000-$300,000, which is unnecessary. But with all the other aspects, things like appointing the trustee, choice of the property, decision when you sell, you as the member of that private syndicate make those sort of decisions. As far as upfront costs are concerned, you just pay the costs of establishment and acquisition only. Now, I mean, you'll have a unit trust because that's the, we discussed that in an earlier podcast, probably the most tax-effective way to do it. But the cost to establish a unit trust, you would incur yourself if you were buying the property. The only difference here is it's split amongst 20 people, 15, 20 people, however many there are. You don't have all the other add-on costs, entrepreneurial fees, the costs of the product disclosure statement, etc. And more importantly, you can have regular updates, because you are in touch with the accountant, the property manager, and you can have, with the syndicates I set up, I tried to have 6 monthly get-togethers with all of the members where it becomes more like an investment club where you and your spouse would come along and you could actually meet everybody else and exchange ideas and have input into the strategy for the ongoing management of the property. And so those are the sort of things that make a private syndicate far more appealing. But one of the things that in putting the rules of how a syndicate operates together, I don't know what the magic of 4 years is, but what I find is that generally about that time, individuals have changes of circumstances. They either get married, they get divorced, they have kids, they go overseas, whatever it is, there's some reason I've noticed over the last 30, 40 years that there will invariably be with most of my clients some change in their circumstances. And so what we wrote into the trust deed, and this is the other thing that you, the trust deed relates to the specific unit trust buying the property. And the trust deed needs to be a working document. And so what I did was it took what most solicitors would call a vanilla document. In other words, it just complies with the statutory requirements. I took it and included all the marketing things, all the reasons why you would want to get involved in a private syndicate, and wove them into the syndicate document itself. So it becomes a live working document. Sure, it has to have all the compliance aspects. But one of the things I built in there was that every 4 years, there has to be a mandatory review of the property by everyone. And you have to determine whether or not the syndicate is going to continue. And if you can't agree, well, then the property gets sold. Now, the other thing is that, and we'll come to it in a moment, the level of borrowing is fairly conservative, but there has to be a 75% majority vote to continue to hold the property. And if it's not, the property is sold and the syndicate is wound up. Now, if you're one of the 25% that don't want to continue, then the trustee for the syndicate has to buy you out. Now, because that's the case, in other words, effectively, trustee, it's a corporate trustee, but it represents all the members. So it means that they redeem your units in the unit trust. So it happens, it means that everyone, if you are bought out, those units are removed from the deal, so everyone's equity effectively remains the same but goes up in value because you're no longer there. But they pay you out at a prearranged formula for getting out, which again is built into the trust deed. Now, what happens though is that generally there are a couple of investors who they themselves decide that they want to increase their relative equity. And so knowing that the trustee must buy you out, it creates competition, because if they want to have increased their share of the equity in the unit trust, they then have to actively participate in the buyout. So rather than having to go cap in hand, as you do with a public syndicate, and go to them and say, look, we'd like you to buy us out, and there is no obligation to do that, they will then say, look, just walk around and we'll circulate it amongst the other 200 or 300 members, and if someone wants to buy you out, well and good. Here, you will be bought out if you don't want to continue. Therefore, they know they have to act quickly to come to a deal with you to buy you out. So those sort of things are built into the trust deed. And as I said, there's only 20 investors and there's only $2 million of equity brought into the trust. And again, that's an ASIC requirement. So long as you've got no more than 20 and no more than 2 million, then you don't need a product disclosure statement. So that means that you're looking to buy a property up to around about between $4 and $4.5 million. And the reason I say that is because the borrowing is conservative. It is only at 65% of the value of the property. And the reason for that is that one of the other problems you have with the syndicate is that when the loan is entered into, all the syndicate members all become what's called joint and severally liable. In other words, not only are you reliable for your own proportion of the loan, but if someone else can't meet their requirement, if the loan's called up, you then have to chip in and cover that. So by taking a 65% borrowing, it means that you can get what's called non-recourse finance. And that means that there is no personal guarantees required by any of the participants, which means, again, that it limits your exposure. So your total exposure then is only for the equity that you put in to the syndicate. And that makes it fairly attractive. So not only do we avoid the costs, but we build in to the trust deed the flexibility for exiting and avoiding or distasteful liabilities that quite often run with a purchase of this nature.
I'm not sure if you touched on it in an earlier podcast, but what would be the basic buying criteria when a syndicate is identifying and choosing a suitable property?
Well, again, yes, there are strict buying criteria, and things like that the property will be suitable for office, industrial or retail use. You know, again, retail I would have as a third in line, but that's the extent of it. So you're not getting into peripheral things like hotels and other disparate type of uses. It has to comply with legal and town planning requirements. It would need to be reasonably new so that you can get good depreciation, low ongoing maintenance, timeless design so that it's easily adaptable, ideally possible for subdivision, and, you know, not of a specialised nature. And when you're looking at tenants, you would generally look at a five-year lease term, making sure that the rentals are realistic, not above market at the time, and that if it's a smaller property, that the majority of the property is occupied by a single solid tenant. So in many respects, the investment criteria mirror what we talked about before with in earlier podcasts. But once again, they are spelt out and included in the trust deed. So when you get the trust deed, I mean, generally there's one or two things you do. You either file it and don't read it, or you send it off to your solicitor. But what we don't want to have happen is you can't have everybody's solicitor having input. So by creating a trust deed that is a working document, there's a summary page that lists all these things that we've talked about. So you can go to page so-and-so, clause such-and-such, and you can see for yourself that the reasons that you have chosen to get involved are embodied in the trust deed. So those are the sort of criteria we talk about.
Are there any properties that should be specifically excluded?
Yes, as far as properties excluded, as I said, properties that are of a speculative nature we wouldn't look at, or of a specialised nature. As I said, things like hotels or motels, or even specifically designed property for a very specialised use, that if that tenant left, it would be difficult to adapt the property for a more general use. So, I mean, it might sound nice to have a purpose-built building, but that's fine while that tenant's there. And even if you don't have the problem, when you come to sell, if it's getting close to the end of the lease, I mean, you might have been lucky and scored an 8-year lease and you sell it after 5, so there's 3 years to run. Sounds good, but if the incoming buyer looks at it and says, well, what if the tenant leaves? They're not going to pay you the same sort of price that you would expect. As far as price, as I said, you're generally capped, if you're going to conservatively borrow, at around about 4.25, maybe 4.3 million. So properties over that obviously wouldn't be considered either.
At what stage do people actually put their equity on the table, so to speak?
Now, this is where probably the greatest departure occurs with private and public syndicates. The reason for large entrepreneurial fees by the person putting it together is that they have to go out and cough up the option fees on properties while they bring all the equity together. And that's a risk, and therefore they need to be rewarded for that. Sometimes I think overly rewarded, but nonetheless, because there may be several times they take option fees and the deals don't go ahead. So they have to wear that cost. With a private syndicate, what happens is that at the time you decide to go in, you place into the solicitor's trust account 30% of your intended equity, which is put into an interest-bearing account. And the reason for that is that, remember, we said that you're borrowing 65%. So 30% of 35% represents just over 10% of the value of the property. And that means that there is enough funds in the kitty to, once everyone agrees, to immediately pay a 10% deposit to secure the property. And this comes back to the being in the best position to negotiate a good deal. So unlike the public syndicates who go to the vendor and say, look, we want to get the best deal, and now we've got that, we can't pay you for 3 or 4 months. In fact, we're not sure we will be able to do that. We want an option over the property. With the private syndicates, the way I've found them to work and structure them is that you negotiate the best deal, or I would help you, or whoever it is helps you negotiate the best deal, but you can immediately have a solicitor draw a check to cover the 10% deposit. Then the trust deed that you've entered into says that the remaining 70% of your equity that you've decided to invest into the syndicate is then payable within 28 days of the purchase contract having been executed and exchanged. So that means if you've got a 60-day settlement, your initial 30%, which covers the 10% of the purchase price, is in the solicitor's trust account. As soon as the contracts are exchanged, you are then notified and you've got 28 days. So the idea for that is that there's a buffer of 30 days if it's a 60-day settlement, so that if someone does happen to be overseas or incapacitated for the short period, most of the money will come in within 28 days, but there is coverage so that for unforeseen circumstances, all the money can be in so that settlement can occur within the 60-day period.
Is there anything else we need to know?
No, not really. But what I will do is I, a few years ago, put together an e-book to summarise all of this. And so what I will make available on the website for you, Ken, is a copy of that, which people can go on to propertybriefings.com and to this episode, number 39, and can download a copy of that to read at their leisure and understand. And if they've got any queries, feel free to email me and I'll certainly do my best to answer them.
Well, it all seems fairly straightforward and certainly gives me a lot more comfort about stepping into the commercial property market. So thanks for that.
Well, Ken, I just hope it clears up a few grey areas for people. And I'll look forward to catching up with you again next week.
I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.